Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Today's program is a bit of a departure for us. Instead of talking to a corporate boss or tackling an economic issue facing South Florida, today we present separate conversations with two best-selling authors calling South Florida home. Now, they don't write business books, but they write almost everything else. James Patterson and Brad Meltzer have scores of bestsellers between them, but it's not because of a strategic business plan-like approach. These guys are writers, not business or marketing experts, they both say. They write about what interests them, not to fill some opportunity in the publishing market. They've created a library of titles stretching across genres and mediums. Mysteries and thrillers, young adult and historical biographies for kids, comic book characters, documentary films, a cartoon series on public television. They both work from South Florida. Patterson moved to Palm Beach County in the late 1990s. Meltzer came here as a kid in the early 1980s. They don't want to be defined by their ever-growing list of successful projects across books, television, film, and elsewhere.
Brad, how do you see yourself as an author? How do you see yourself as a...
Bald.
Both authors had literal answers to that same question.
I see myself as like 6'7", good-looking, 30 years old.
No big deal is how Patterson describes his success.
I'm Jack's dad. I'm Sue's husband. I write books. I've never gotten a big head about it. Jack is very comfortable, our son, with the fact that I do the books. But it's no big deal. It is what it is. You know, somebody's a dentist and I write books, and so be it. I've been poor. I've been middle class, and then I was poor and middle class again. Now I'm rich. On balance, I prefer being rich. But I'm really happy that I went through the other groups, because I do understand, I think, where people come from better than a lot of people do. I mean, Donald Trump was never poor. I think it's really useful to know where people come from.
Where Patterson is now is a multi-million dollar mansion in Palm Beach. Patterson and Meltzer both made names for themselves as thriller writers. Both had their first books rejected over and over and over again before breaking through and eventually breaking out in a crowded market.
You know, someone said to me once that whenever you achieve a bit of success, that you're emotionally trapped at that age forever. And my first book was published when I was 27 years old. So I forever see myself as like this 27-year-old kid who's just trying to get his book published, because my first book got 24 rejection letters. And there were only 20 publishers and I got 24 rejection letters. So I still forever see myself as that. And you know what? That's all I ever want to see myself, because I never want to think I made it. The moment I think I made it, I'm finished.
Both are out with new books. Both are staples of bestseller lists. They successfully maneuver between publishing categories and mediums, becoming personalities in their own right.
The X factor in every book is, does the writer still love what they're doing? If you read any book you love, the moment it starts, it's more than just a good plot or even good characters, but there's that momentum that just feels like the bullet train has left the station and the writer's like, I'm leaving and you can come on or not, but this is going to be amazing. And those are the best rides. And the X factor there is, does the writer love this? And I never, ever want to sit down and hate it or be tired of it or feel like I'm doing it for, whether it's money or to claim success. To me, it has to be as pure as it was when I was 27, which was just a cold desire to get this book out there so that, you know, someone may notice. And I feel like if I can get back to that spot, then my drive is you know, not something that's going to dry up.
I mean, my favorite books are way over my 100 Years of Solitude, Ulysses, whatever. And it occurred to me that I was not capable of writing 100 Years of Solitude. I just did not have that skill set. And when I don't know when, somewhere in my 20s, I read Day of the Jackal and Exorcist. And I went, ooh, there's good craft here. Maybe I could write things like this. And then I tried it with the Thomas Berryman number. And I enjoyed the process. I liked it. And people that read Thomas Berryman number, even my detractors would go, ooh, pretty good writing in here, you know.
That first book from Patterson won the Best First Novel Award from the Mystery Writers of America. That was 1977. There have been dozens of books from him since, with over 300 million copies sold worldwide. So, still to come, Patterson and what he calls the caricature assassination of his writing.
People have their ideas about, you know, who you are, and in my case, it's usually not right.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. James Patterson called me a nasty man during our conversation. We'd been talking for about 20 minutes in his home office in Palm Beach. His home sits on a couple of acres along the Intercoastal Waterway. The Atlantic Ocean is right across the street. He said it jokingly, I think. We'd been having a winding conversation about his writing career, and I had asked him a few questions about the business that his work has become and his use of co-authors to expand the James Patterson line of books.
I've written a bunch by myself.
No, I know you have. I know you have. I don't. Yeah. I'm not dismissing that at all. Yeah. But how?
This is a nasty man.
No. You think so?
I don't. I have no idea. I'm just listening to you. Yeah.
Well, what I'm
putting you in a box.
You're putting me in a box.
Your question.
Fair enough. Yeah.
James Patterson does not like to be put into a box, and his career shows that. He may have started out as a mystery writer, then thrillers, a few romance novels, nonfiction here and there, young adult, kids, picture books. There also are the films and television series based on his books, but he doesn't buy the idea there's a James Patterson brand.
People have their ideas about, you know, who you are, and it, in my case, it's usually not right.
Patterson sells millions of books each year. He has sold tens of millions of books in his career, hundreds of millions, in fact, and his output seems to be increasing with age. He turned 72 in March. He has three separate books published that month alone. In April, five of his books are due to be released, but don't ask him about his brand.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
There's the James Patterson Inc., the James Patterson brand.
That's not me. I didn't put that friggin' thing up there. That's the New York Times.
It says James Patterson Inc., the New York Times magazine article.
Once again, somebody walks in with a point of view. Yeah. And it's not that it's a wrong point of view, but it's not much about me. It's more about somebody trying to put somebody in a box.
Yeah.
So put me in a box.
The walls of Patterson's home office are lined with bookshelves. In a corner of the room, the tall shelves give way to a counter forming a desk. There's a telephone and some papers scattered across the top of it. A window looks due east out over Ocean Boulevard and to the Atlantic Ocean. Now, hanging on the wall just to the right is a framed cover of a 2010 New York Times magazine. It has a photo of Patterson at a desk in a monochrome room with a simple light. He's writing longhand, and piled up next to him is an endless stack of books. Their jackets only vary by primary colors. The headline reads, James Patterson, Inc. It may be hanging on his office wall, but he rejects the idea as one of the boxes, as others have put him in.
So what box do you build for yourself?
I don't have a box. The most important things for me are family, people that are around me. And that's what drives me more than anything else. And writing kids' books now, I certainly am not doing that for the brand. Oh, because I'm going to get kids when they grow up, right? No.
You tell me.
No, but who would do that? I guess somebody would. But what's the point?
I mean, you know, there's
what
been a...
What would be the point? I don't even get it. I'm not wired that way. I love to tell stories. There's certain kinds of stories I don't think I could tell. I can't tell 100 Years of Solitude because I'm not a good enough writer. I can't tell, you know, real romances. I don't really quite understand how those work. I can write a love story, but I can't do, you know, that kind of whatever. I'm not saying that they're good, bad, or indifferent. I could not do a Tom Clancy. I don't know how generals think or talk. It's a little, I couldn't do that.
So how do you explain then the business that you have built up? It has been subject. You have been subject
to business, but whatever. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. I want to hear how you don't think of your volume of work.
I write stories. In terms of, and I think all of us would do this if they had the skill set. Yes, I do pay attention to the covers. And I have a simple thing about covers. Ideally, I see it. I want it.
Big typeface, strong colors.
Yeah, it could be. But I think that a lot of writers would want to control the covers if they could. So I'm in a position where I can. I also have the skill set, which is developed. I do, having gone through, you know, enough packaging and whatever, so I do. And it's not that I'm 100%, but I certainly know that principle, you're not going to go wrong with it. I saw it. I want it. Well, it's different now, but you know, when it was all in stores, nobody ever bought a book that they didn't pick up. So you got to pick it up.
How do you explain your success and your longevity and your productivity?
I eat right. I exercise every day. That's a longevity thing. I think I'm a good story. I think I'm a very good storyteller. I don't think I'm a great craftsperson. I don't think I'm a great stylist. I think that Thomas Berryman had a lot of style to it. I'm more interested in giving people a good time. I try to pretend there's somebody sitting across from me. I don't want them to get up till I finish the story. I like to tell stories. I went from being a really bad speaker when I was in advertising, very shy. I remember the guy that hired me said that he had interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people. He said he had never interviewed anybody that was more shy than I was.
Patterson got over that shyness. He became the North American chairman of that advertising firm, J. Walter Thompson. He has been writing novels since the 1970s. The breakout came in 1993 with Along Came a Spider. He paid to produce and air television commercials in key cities, and readers first met the character Alex Cross. He was eventually played in the movies by Morgan Freeman. There are now 24 Alex Cross novels. The most recent was published in November.
I don't work for a living. I play for a living. This is play for me. I don't particularly like to do interviews, but I love sitting and writing stories. I do it 7 days a week. I think I have a big imagination, and I mean that's the strength. And the weakness is I could be a better stylist. I just don't feel like doing it.
All around Patterson's office is evidence of his productivity. Stacks and stacks of manuscripts are neatly arranged in piles, each one of them topped with a blue sheet of paper. Printed in bold letters on each paper is the name of the project underneath. There have to be at least 20 stacks around the room.
There are a lot of them you can see going all the way around the room, and those are all live projects. Some nonfiction, some fiction. And in all cases, I think in all cases, but let's say in 95% of the cases, I have written a 50 to 80 page outline. And when I do a co-authoring thing, almost always, in almost every case, I want to get pages every 2 or 3 weeks. And then I will get on the phone with the person and go, yay, you're the best, or hold it. We're off the track here in terms of I'm just not interested in it, or we've lost the voice, or there is no voice, or let's go over a couple of these chapters, or let's talk about the writing a little bit, or whatever, or yay, you're the best. And it kind of goes like that. At a certain point, I will usually do. I don't do as much as I used to. Sometimes in the beginning, I would do 4 or 5 drafts when the thing came in. I don't do that anymore, partly because I'm working with better people, partly because the people who've stayed with me kind of get it at this point. Like, you know, Maxine Pietro, it's interesting with some of them. There are a couple of them I've never met in person.
Your co-authors.
We've only talked on the phone, but we've become pretty good friends. We laugh and, you know, whatever. But it's those, you know, every couple of weeks.
How do you manage this process if you've got these 20-some-odd projects going on, different genres, different stages of development?
Ringing.
The phone's ringing, the fax machine's going on.
The fax is going, and I'm writing, and, you know, I couldn't possibly get writer's block other than right after the operation where I was like, because there's always something to something else to go to. I have this pile of ideas, and when it's time, I will usually go through there and maybe make a list of 5, 6, 7 ideas that I find interesting, not commercial as much as just I have some interest in writing about them. Then I usually pick one and try to write some points, some how this story might go. And if I feel, I don't remember who said, somebody was talking about storytelling, and they said the secret to storytelling, not writing novels, but the secret to storytelling is if you can write, if you have a beginning and an end, you're known as a really good storyteller. If you can do the middles, you're a genius. Now, in novels, kind of you have to do the middles too. In movies, they kind of do the beginnings, and they kind of, that's it. No middle, no end. They just, screw it. You know, you didn't get it, your problem. You were insulted, your problem. Give us the money. Yeah, so if I feel there's a story there, And I always think I know the ending. I almost never know the ending. When I, you know, and then I'll write a longer outline, which will usually be anywhere from 40 to 70 pages. And I do it just, I don't wind up, I mean, I might, there might be 100 and some chapters in the book. I might do 80 chapters or 70 chapters in the outline. It's what's going to drive that chapter. Why, you know, with the movies, I always say, don't do the cemetery scene. You know what I mean? With the, unless something's going to happen, and I don't have it where somebody jumps on the casket, and and don't have it that the shooter arrives in a car and what, you know. So, and if you don't have something wonderful, don't do that scene. You don't have an infinite number of scenes, but you have an incredible number of scenes in any story, and you just have to pick what those scenes are and why that scene. I did at one of the book shots that I did, the shorter novellas, it was called 113 Minutes. But it wasn't 113 minutes in real time. It was 113 minutes over the course of like 8 months. And it was just this scene was 4 minutes, and this scene was 3 minutes, and this scene was 11 minutes. And those were the scenes for me that really told the story. So same here. And I've had editors who've tried to work with the writers that I work with, and I listen to them. I go, you're not telling them the right stuff. You're not.
What do they miss?
I don't know. It's all mechanical. It's just not. It's not from the heart. It's not. And I'll even, you know, with one of the children's editors, I'll talk all the time about, stop intellectualizing about all this stuff. Gut. What's the gut? What is your, you know. And once again, in terms of the scene, what drives that scene? Why is the scene? And if you're in there, and I will usually second draft, third draft, I will put be there at the top of chapters over and over and over again, reminding me to put myself in the damn scene. You got to feel it. You got to be there. For the stuff I'm writing. Seriously, you're there, or this character is really there. And you read a lot of the stuff and you go like, you know, it's okay. Now, in serious fiction, you'll get, you know, they're really good writers. They're capable of, you know, somebody making a lemon meringue pie and thinking about their grandmother's lemon meringue pies and relating it to the, you know, and it's, nothing happens, and yet it's quite wonderful. But they're very good. But something does happen. Something happens emotionally. Something happens in your head. But in these things, it's usually something more intense, but you've got to get it, and it can't just be a cliche.
Patterson still writes longhand, and he's been as prolific as ever. Since 2012, he has released at least a dozen books each year. He's had 2 surgeries in recent years, the last one this past summer, a 5-hour procedure. And he says he's noticed the ideas are slowing down a little.
I found for about a month that my imagination was like, it was going this far, and it was just stopping. And I don't know if it was going to come back.
Did that concern you?
Yeah, not like, you know, I tend to accept life. I can no longer dunk a basketball. You just go, okay. I do, within reason. But yeah, it was disturbing.
One of his latest novels is Liar, Liar. It's the third book featuring Australian police investigator Harriet Blue. The 2 other books followed the same titling strategy. The first was Never Never, followed by 50-50. The 4th installment will be called Hush Hush. The series follows Blue's descent from police detective to vigilante murder suspect. Now, Liar, Liar was published in July when Patterson had a different book at the top of the bestseller list, his novel he co-authored with President Clinton. Next week, he will have 2 books on the New York Times bestseller lists, The House Next Door for fiction and Dog Diaries on the children's list.
How important is market data to you? I mean,
I don't get any.
You don't ask for any from the publisher.
I don't think they have any worth it. It's not a terribly sophisticated business, and this is nothing against my publisher, and they're quite supportive, but they don't have much. They don't, you know. So I see sales figures, for whatever that means, and that's more just fun. Oh, we're number 4, whatever the hell it is.
What does it mean to you?
It's nice. I know some authors are like, especially at the tippity top, it's like if they're not number one, they get all nuts. I'm like, okay. I think the only times where, the only things that bother me really are you read something, you go, that's just not fair.
You don't think much about how other people are perceiving
you. I don't think about it at all, for the most part. I mean, it comes up every once in a while. And then once again, it's just a matter of whether it's fair. I don't like your books. Okay. I don't like thrillers. Okay. I don't like your writing. Okay.
The market has said something different for years and years and years.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the, it's just a little, but it, not that it means anything, you know, hundreds of thousands of people don't like my books, but fortunately tens of millions do. And, you know, that's just a little, that's sort of like ad talk, but there's some truth to that.
Best-selling author James Patterson. We spoke with him in his home office in Palm Beach. Still to come, our conversation continues. Patterson's pivot from mysteries and thrillers to children's books and his literacy efforts focused on Florida.
I think the biggest passion I have right now is just to help get kids reading.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Don't forget, you can follow along on Twitter. At WLRN is our Twitter handle. And if you've missed any of this program, as well as any of our Sunshine Economy programs, you can find a podcast of all of our programs on iTunes. Use the podcast app and search for Sunshine Economy. Now, today's program, admittedly, is a little bit different. We are featuring separate interviews with two best-selling authors who call South Florida home, Brad Meltzer and James Patterson. Patterson made his name first as a mystery and thriller novelist. About 15 years ago, he started writing for younger readers, fantasy books first, then other series. He has credited his son Jack for his branching out.
Jack wasn't a big reader, and he's a bright kid, but one, I don't know, he was about 7 or 8, and Sue and I said to Jack, you're going to read every day? And he said, do I have to? And he said, yeah, unless you want to live in the garage. But we're going to go out. And so we went out, and between the bookstores and the library, we got him a dozen books. And they ranged from Percy Jackson to A Wrinkle in Time. It was nice, you know. And by the end of the summer, he read about a dozen books. And his reading scores, you know. And then when he took his SSATs, he would get an 800 in reading. So now, not all kids, it's going to go that way. But if they read enough, they're going to get competent or very good or whatever. And it will affect their lives, because reading has to be, it has to be built. You can't get through high school without being a competent reader. How, you know, Abraham, you can't do it. It's just, and it seems impossible, because it is impossible. So we have to get these kids to learn how to read. You know, and I always talk about, you know, you just don't want your choices to be limited. You want to have more choices. You don't want to, you know, maybe you do want to wind up here, but you don't want that to be your only choice. You know?
When we spoke with Patterson recently in his home office in Palm Beach, he called his books for kids the most valuable thing he does.
And that is, you know, I think the biggest passion I have right now is just to help get kids reading.
He has put up money in Florida to push for childhood literacy. A year ago, he donated $3 million to the University of Florida College of Education. The money is going toward what is now called the James Patterson Literacy Challenge. The program aims to help schools and teachers to, quote, change their literacy culture. Its focus is working with reading teachers and literacy instruction. 57% of Florida third graders were reading at or above their grade level last year, according to the Florida Department of Education, using the Florida Standards Assessment, the FSA. A national assessment says 41% of Florida fourth graders are reading at a proficient or advanced level, though. 5 elementary schools are in Patterson's Literacy Challenge program, and he hopes to expand that statewide.
That, to me, is the most exciting thing I'm doing, because if that when I'll go out with, you know, big groups of librarians and teachers and whatever, I go, I'm here to save lives. That will save lives.
In addition to literacy programs, Patterson is experimenting with new methods of delivering his stories. His most recent launched in October. Now, the industry calls it interactive fiction. His book, The Chef, was serialized on the Facebook Messenger app through chat bubbles, audio, and video clips. It is not the entire book, though. That will be published traditionally in February. And Patterson wasn't all that satisfied anyway with the experiment or with his partner.
I love the idea. I don't think we executed it as well as we coulda, shoulda, woulda. They were interesting to work with.
Facebook?
Yeah, they were tough, not in a good way. Even though some of the people were quite nice, but it was...
Tell me a little more.
It should have been a lot, lot better. The idea, theoretically, and what I wanted to do is to take the book, I really wanted to cut it down to about a third, and I wanted to shoot a lot more film. So you'd be reading. So the idea of this thing was you would read three or four pages, and then it would go to film. And some of the story would, you know, you'd get like 3 or so minutes of film telling that story at that point. And then you'd go back and you'd be reading. And then, you know, because it was chef, you'd have some food prep in there. And, you know, so it's kind of a cool idea. And so it's an infant idea right now. But I think we could have done a lot better job.
Best-selling author James Patterson. We spoke with him recently at his home in Palm Beach County. Now, still to come, talking with author Brad Meltzer. And what runs through all of his work, his books, and his television work.
Everything I work on, whether it's the fiction, whether it's the nonfiction, whether it's television or the kids' books, they do have one thing in common. It's my core belief.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. Brad Meltzer says he should not be a best-selling author and television host, and maybe he wouldn't be except for moving to South Florida when he was a kid.
The idea that you can take a kid who used to get into fistfights in Brooklyn, New York, and who's no one in his immediate family went to a 4-year college, and somehow, some way gets on the bestseller list defies all logic. My sister got a PhD, and I went on to become a novelist. It totally defies the logic of what we should have been growing up. And it was in Florida where we got our chance to be something different.
He came to South Florida in 1983 and still calls it home. Like James Patterson, Meltzer has successfully worked across traditional publishing industry categories, thrillers, comic books, children's books, and nonfiction. He's written for television and hosted 2 cable television programs mixing mystery and history. He's had more than a half dozen bestseller books, including his most recent, The First Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill George Washington. But that book's early success was not guaranteed despite his past success.
I went to my publisher and I said, I want to do this nonfiction book. And they actually said, well, we're not really interested. It doesn't sound that interesting. And so I went to another new publisher and they published it. But it was rejected by my publisher 3 years ago.
Meltzer was in St. Louis on his book tour when we spoke recently.
Is there a Brad Meltzer brand, in your opinion?
Oh, gosh, I never even think about that. I mean, I can tell you this. Everything I work on, whether it's the fiction, whether it's the nonfiction, whether it's television or the kids' books, they do have one thing in common. It's my core belief. I believe ordinary people change the world. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care how much money you make. I believe in regular people and their ability to affect change in this world. And it's why I believe in my fictional characters and George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and Rosa Parks. It's why I believe in Superman. The most important part of the story is not Superman. The most important part of the story is Clark Kent, because we're all Clark Kent. We all know what it's like to be boring and ordinary and wish we'd do something incredibly beyond ourselves. And even the TV shows, we did the same thing. It was never about the famous person, but they were stories about what we're all capable of on our very best days. And that's the one thing that I think they have in common. We don't advertise it. We don't call that out. But I know that is my personal kind of compass that I follow.
You think the audience picks up on that? And at this point in your career, given your output and your productivity, that if it's got your name on it, it's going to have that kind of philosophy behind it, regardless of if it's a multi-hundred page fiction or nonfiction book or a picture book for a child or a cable television program.
Yeah, I hope so, but you just never know. I mean, again, when we did The First Conspiracy, just came out in the past week, we had no idea what was going to happen because it was just brand new. And you hope that people follow you, but you know, there's something. When you're in the creative field, there's some level of faith of you just got to leap off the cliff and realize you got to take the leap. Most businesses, most jobs, and at least you know when you're in college and you're in whatever grad school you go to, your life is kind of like you're on an escalator, right? You do well, you study hard, you go to a good college. Then you work hard, you study, you get good grades, you get a good job. And at some point, life is not an escalator anymore because life's not a meritocracy. You can work hard in your job and kind of reach some peak. And life is not the escalator. What it becomes is a trapeze. And what you got to do is go to the edge and leap. And the one thing that I'm proud of is I'm not afraid to leap. Let me tell you how I learned to swim. I was, had to be, whatever, 10 years old, and Joey Tusa's younger brother, I saw swimming in the deep end of the pool at camp. And I couldn't swim in the deep end of the pool. And I saw this kid who was 3 or 4 years younger than me swimming in the deep end. And I was going, that kid's swimming in the deep end? This was what I did. I immediately went over to the diving board in the deep end. And such a dumb idea, but this is what I did. And I went on the diving board, and I jumped into the deep end of the pool. I obviously jumped sideways so I could get to the ladder quicker, but I was like, I'm going to figure out how to swim. And you better believe I figured out right there how to swim. And when I learned how to ride a bicycle, maybe I was a little younger or older there, depending on the age, I remember seeing Ellen Nagel's father in Brooklyn, New York, was taking her training wheels off her bike. I saw that and I said, Ellen Nagel's going to ride without training wheels? And I said to her dad, can you take the training wheels off my bike? And he was like, sure. So I got on my bike. He took my training wheels off and I went to this like driveway that kind of sloped downward in the backyard. And I just went. And I'm sure I crashed over and over, but I learned how to ride that bike. And I know it, none of that's conscious, but that's the one thing. And I feel like any success we've had in terms of trying something new is I can leap.
It's interesting in those two examples, you don't mention at all any of the failure that may have happened. You know, you had to struggle to get over to the ladder to swim, or a friend may have had to come over a couple of times, or even dismissing. I'm sure that I fell down on my bike a couple of times, but it's the focus on the success that you remember.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's good. I didn't even think about that. That's exactly right. I mean, my dad, when he was 39 years old, lost his job and moved down from Brooklyn, New York to Miami, Florida. He called it the do-over of life at 39. He took the leap. I was terrified. He had no job. We had no money. He was always bad with money. He had $1,200 to his name. We had no place to live. We lived with my grandmother, and it was a bad time. Money was really hard on my family. And I guess I got to give full credit to my dad that he just went for it. But I will say my dad could never really find for many years until later in life find the success he wanted professionally. He just couldn't. He always felt like, you know, he was always cursed and he couldn't find the right person. He was blamed other people and always everything bad that happened, it was someone else's fault. And I just saw that growing up. And I think for me, success was very important at a young age because money was really hard. And what they did when I got to Florida is my parents gave a fake address so that I could go to the wealthy public school. So I got to go to North Miami Beach Senior High School. At the time was one of the top schools in Miami-Dade. And suddenly I was going to this school where, you know, people had two cars and everyone had a nice house and everyone was going to college. And I remember them saying, Brad, you taking the PSAT? I'm like, I don't know what that is, but if you're taking it, I'm taking it. Like, I'll jump in that side of the pool. And I was just determined. So it was never about, I knew I was going to get beat up, but I didn't, you know, to me, it was always about trying to get to that success point. And I think truthfully, it's probably also just my internal clock of, you know, I still am the ever eternal optimist, you know, as someone who says ordinary people change the world. That is just how I'm wired.
Optimistic, but certainly not risk averse, obviously as a child, but even professionally, as you have talked about going into these different genres, and despite one success in one genre with one publisher, still facing rejection and just moving on. Where else does that come from? How do you find that? I guess the professional bravery that as you move away from where your initial audience is meeting you, that they're going to come with, or that another audience is going to find you.
There is an inherent faith that you have to have when it comes to creativity, because you have to really believe that whatever you're selling or creating is great. Otherwise, why go out with it? There's something in you that says, you know, if you just wanted to do it for yourself, you'd do it and show no one. But there's some need and some faith that happens. But there is no, to get down to your question, there's no There's no corporation here. It's never been. It's just, it's my family.
There's no business strategy. There's no
annual meeting, right?
Plan.
No.
There's no, let's look at the business model and fight, you know.
Right, like I know.
There's a place in the portfolio here where Meltzer isn't in terms of the publishing world or cable television. Maybe we ought to consider this
kind of project.
Oh,
God, no. For me, I just find what I like. When I had kids, I wrote kids' books. When I had nonfiction stories, I wrote nonfiction books. I love superheroes. I'm going to write comic books. It's never been a let's ID and see what the fastest growing subgenre is, and that we'll be able to. Because the truth is, if I was smart, I should never do any of this. If I wanted to really, if this was about cold, hard cash and making money, I should just write thrillers. I should write a thriller every year, and I would be a bigger, better thriller writer for it. I would be. And that's what sells in thrillers, is you got to be there every year. That is what builds an audience. And doing all these other things actually hurts me as a thriller writer because it keeps me away from doing a thriller a year. But if I had to do the same thing every year for 20 years, I would hate it. I'd learn to hate what I now love. And by going away from it and doing kids' books and doing television, the grass is always greener. It makes me turn back and say, you know what? I really miss those thrillers. I want to go do those now. So for me, I think it's actually also a little bit of self-preservation. It makes me not hate what I love so much.
As you look back in your career, how do you think through the moments that you've pivoted or you have taken on a new genre or even a new medium and entered into that, what can be a really risky proposition for you as you're stretching yourself away from what you have created for yourself in the marketplace?
Yeah, you know, I wish maybe if I went to like business school or had some kind of degree like that, I'd look at this and say, well, how does this affect my quote unquote business or whatever, you know, brand? I never ever do that. My one true north is simply, do I love and desire to do this project? In fact, the first thing that we genre jumped, you know, back when I started, if you were a thriller writer, you wrote thrillers. That's what you did. Stay in your lane. And then I remember the director, Kevin Smith, was writing Green Arrow at the time. And no one liked comics back then. This is 15, almost 20 years ago. Comics were not cool back then. And I grew up on comic books. I love Superman and Batman. And I'd always been putting, since my very first book, hiding comic book references in my novels. And a DC Comics editor saw that I was doing that. The director, Kevin Smith, was writing Green Arrow, which was then DC Comics' number one superhero book at the time. And he was leaving, and there was no one else in comics. Everyone else in comics was a comic writer, and no one from outside of comics was doing anything. And they said to me, this is our number one selling superhero book. If we take it and give it to you, everyone's going to go, why are they giving this to some novelist? If we take it and give it to someone else, they'll be like, you know, where's the director? So, you know, we're going to give it to you, and everyone's going to have to think twice. And what they said to me was, you're going to either succeed on a big stage or fail on a big stage because it's our number one superhero book. And I didn't even hesitate. I was like, oh, I'll take that chance any day. Why? Because I just wanted to write a superhero book. I've been waiting my whole life to write superheroes. And I tried. And I remember at the time, you know, people were like, why are you slumming in comic books? Or a novelist isn't supposed to be writing comic books. And I was like, I don't know. What are you supposed to? Who wrote these rules? Who said that? And then when I had kids, I was like, I want to write children's books. And the publisher, my actual publisher, rejected them. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go to a different publisher. And I said to the publisher, I said, if you don't love it, don't publish it. Don't publish it just because I write a lot of thrillers for you and you feel like you have to kind of service that part. They said, we don't love it. And I said, what do you mean you don't love it?
How'd that conversation go?
Just like that. I mean, I pretended that it didn't hurt, but it did. But I said, that's okay. I want to go with someone who loves what I do, not someone who's doing it out of some, you know, feel like a commitment to it for something else. And we took it to another publisher, and it hit the bestseller list. And everyone was like, how'd you do that? And I'm like, because I love my kids. I don't know. I just tried. And the same thing happened with the IM series, and the same thing with the TV show. I just said, I want to do a TV show. And I was at an agency, a big, huge Hollywood agency. And I said, I want to do TV. And they totally set up a meeting for me that was a joke. In fact, I went in. I realized looking back that they said they were going to have me meet a big TV agent. And I think it was honestly someone's assistant. It was like a joke meeting. And I sat down in the meeting and I said, yeah, I want to do television. And I wrote this book, The 10th Justice. And this kid looks at me and he says, This kid has to be 12 years old, and he's like, oh, wait, you wrote The Tenth Justice? I love that book. And I realized this is not a meeting about me. They know nothing about me. That was just like to make me feel good. So I quit the agency right there. I literally said, I'm out of here. And I went to William Morris Endeavor, which was back then called just Endeavor. And I walked in and I said, I want to do television. And because I walked in and arrived like that, they gave me their one of their TV agents. And we got Jack and Bobby on the air within the year. And suddenly I was doing television. And again, it was just because I always try to find the person who believes in what I believe in. And I never, ever think of it as like, I'm building some kind of palace and I need to have these four pillars that will hold it up. And I need a television and a children's book and a so-and-so. I just do what I think at that moment I have the story to tell.
Best-selling author Brad Meltzer, still to come, in the ever-changing publishing business, meeting the book-buying audience where it is.
I'm the guinea pig. I'm like, whatever you want to try, I'm in.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Today, we're sharing two interviews with two best-selling authors living in South Florida, James Patterson and Brad Meltzer. This is not a program with us discussing economic data or trends, but rather talking about their prolific and booming careers across writing styles in an industry that's undergoing massive change. It was a year and a half before Amazon was founded when Patterson's first big blockbuster book was published. The website was barely a year and a half old when Meltzer's first book hit the market.
Every time we've had something new, we said, let's try it. And I remember, in fact, my very first book, I went out to Amazon headquarters when Amazon had just started. And they took me in this room and they said, they pulled out this folder that was just hugely thick file folder. And they said, we have this new thing on Amazon where you can leave a review for a book that you read. And there are plenty of people that sell far more books than you, but you have some of the highest level of people reviewing your books in terms of sheer amounts that we've ever seen. And it was because I was 27 at the time, and 20-year-olds are just the early adapters, and they were the first ones on there. So our readers have always been this kind of like early adaptive, like whatever you want to do, let's go do it. So that's the one thing, I don't care what it is, I will always take a shot. It's always fun to me. I'm the guinea pig. I'm like, whatever you want to try, I'm in. I don't care how crazy the idea is. When we did my first book, no one knew who I was. No one had ever heard of me. We literally paid models. This was the editor and I, the publisher of the company. He paid models to sit on the New York City subway that were beautiful holding my book. And they would just sit there. So people would see people reading this book. And I thought that was the I still have no idea if it worked or not. I can't possibly. It was such a crazy idea. But it instilled in me that no one had ever done anything like that before. Now, we of course know that there's like this kind of guerrilla marketing that takes place. There's entire people that go into bars and drink certain beers and order certain liquors so that you can order that too. There's an entire – this was 21 years ago, and we were doing it just because we were like, you know what, let's try it. It may work.
He may want to experiment with how to get his work out into the market, but Meltzer is pretty traditional about creating that work.
I tend to only be able to write at home. That's the truth. The only thing I can do on a plane or in a hotel room is edit. Like when it's all done, I can do edits. That I can do. But whole creation of sitting down and writing brand new words on a page, I really do kind of need a couple hours. I can't just do it for an hour or two. I need to really sit. So I tend to be sitting at my desk by about 9 or 9:30. I futz around on the internet like everybody does and try to be writing by somewhere in 9:30 or 10 o'clock. And I won't take lunch until 2:30. I work straight through the whole day. I just think I need that time to kind of get lost in my imaginary universe and talk to my imaginary friends. At 2:30, I used to then take a very super quick lunch, maybe 15 minutes, half hour at the most, and then I'm back at the desk. On good days, I'll keep writing. The truth is, because of all the different projects, I tend to save all the other projects for the afternoon. So I can do the kids' books in the afternoon. I can do the cartoon show in the afternoon. I can do the nonfiction stuff in the afternoon. But for the thrillers, which takes the most out of me and takes the most creative passion and spirit and energy, that's always gets the full day. And then sometimes I can squeeze. You know, to me, it's like squeezing a sponge until it's dry. Sometimes I can go until 6 or 6:30, and sometimes I'm just done at 4, and that's the way it goes.
How do you feel, though, in terms of going back to that well the next day? You know, knowing full well that this is who you are, this is what you do, and this is how you do it, this is why you do it, and tomorrow you're going to have to do it again.
Yeah, I don't think about it. You know, writing a novel is like building a sandcastle, a grain of sand at a time. You write chapter one or page one, and you got a little grain of sand, plink. Day two, write another page, plink, you got nothing. Day three, third page, plink, still got three grains of sand. But somewhere along the way, you put down another grain, and eventually you start getting some shape, and then you get form, and then you get turrets, and then you have a castle. And it just takes every day. If you write a page a day for a year, you will have a book. It may not be the best book. It may be a messy book. It may ramble, but you'll have a book. It's just that most people on day two go, you know what, forget it. I'm going to write three pages on Wednesday. I'll write four pages on Thursday. I'll take care of it then. And if nothing else, I hope I'm persistent, and I don't mind going and sitting down every day and doing that job. But I've been at this 21 years now, and when I got my 23rd and 24th rejection letter, they were supposed to be actual acceptance letters. They said that the last, I got 22 rejections, and the last two actually liked the book, and they brought me in, they interviewed me. My agent said, I think they're going to make offers, so sit by your phone, and I'm going to call you at whatever the time was. This was pre-cell phones when you sat by the phone. And I sat by the phone waiting to hear what the offers were going to be. And I thought she was going to tell me, I had all this college debt to pay off. I thought she was going to tell me how wealthy I was going to be. And I waited by the phone and I picked up the phone. And I'll never forget, she said, sorry, kiddo. And I was devastated. My gut just bottomed out under me. And I will tell you that all these years later, 21 years later, every single day that I sit down to write, we all have our rituals that we do. One of mine is that I replay that exact moment. I literally replay what room I was in, what kind of phone I was holding. It was one of those clear ones where you could see the wires inside because it was see-through. It was high-tech back then. There was a Formica desk on my left with a swivel lamp that every kid had in college. On my right was a bed that had no headboard. It was a box spring and a mattress. And then I looked over this balcony that was on our apartment at this concrete parking lot. Diagonally down to the left was a fire station with three doors. I count those doors, one, two, three. And I say those words to myself, sorry, kiddo. And I never, ever, ever want to think I made it. I always want to be as hungry as I was when I was 24 years old. I always want to have that desire and that thankfulness that I had from that moment I started. And for 21 years, every day that I sit down to write, I say those words, sorry, kiddo, sorry, kiddo, sorry, kiddo.
And since then, he has sold millions of books. Best-selling author and South Floridian, Brad Meltzer. Pilar Uribe is our technical director. Polly Landis is our booking producer. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.